Arkansas farmers say they're nearing disaster if the federal government doesn't step in. An annual documentary film festival returns to Central Arkansas, and we take a closer look at the state's rich history of string band music. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Dean Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. Arkansas farmers say they're at a crisis point. Falling commodity prices, global market pressures, and steadily rising input costs mean one in three farms in the state could close if the federal government chooses not to step in. I spoke with reporter Philip Powell, who looks into the state of Arkansas agriculture, in a story in the latest issue of the Arkansas Times.
We had a fundamental question that we couldn't really answer, which is the federal government put so much money into our farms. It's one of the most subsidized industries in the whole country as far as, you know, crop insurance, commodity programs, conservation programs, so forth. The federal government put so much money into the farms, and yet they're also struggling to make money. And so we wanted to square that circle with this story. So I did about 4 months of research, interviews with people ranging from farmers who are going out of business, farmers who are barely hanging on, industry leaders, people in the auction business, people, agricultural economists at the University of Arkansas, people at the national level who work in farm advocacy groups. The main takeaway is that right now, the major farms in Arkansas, in eastern Arkansas especially, they are geared towards a type of agriculture that is mostly for exporting. So, you know, they have these huge harvests of rice, of cotton, of soybeans and corn, soybeans especially, and those all get exported to other countries. When farmers are more dependent on global markets for their revenue, if something happens in those global markets that affects their ability to make revenue, then they're going to start to feel the pain. And so a lot of the attention has obviously been on President Trump's tariffs. But what we've uncovered is that, you know, the problems go far deeper. Competitors like Brazil and Argentina are increasing their agricultural productivity. They're increasing their production of soybeans and corn, especially. China's increasing their production of corn. And so if these countries are all producing more of these commodities, then the prices of these commodities for American farmers and their farmers are going to go down.
As you said, the sort of model does not work anymore, given all these changes in the global market. I guess from the experts that you spoke to and the people on the ground, what is the solution to that problem of mass large-scale farming is just not feasible anymore?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's a highly nuanced issue. And so we tried to explore the nuance with the care that it deserves. You know, you have people who have been farming in the Delta now for generations, five, six generations, going back to their great-great-grandparents farming land out there. And so, you know, they don't want to be the last person to farm that land. So it is a deeply sensitive issue. The farmer that we followed for the story, his name is Shannon Hall. And this year was his first year since he has been alive. He's in his mid-50s now, that he has not farmed a crop in eastern Arkansas. You know, he grew up doing this as a little kid. And then started his own farming business where he was, you know, renting land from landowners. Farmers kind of feel in a lot of ways that they are stuck with an unworkable economic model and an unworkable safety net that doesn't necessarily serve their interests best. Our farm country has consolidated into fewer farms, producing more and more of these crops. Our entire system of agriculture in the Arkansas Delta is based upon around 2,000 really large farms in these eastern Arkansas counties that are producing over 90% of our crop output. These farms are already receiving a lot of federal money in many cases. And so now they're asking for the Trump administration to, or in the United States Congress, to approve some kind of federal bailout, as many of them are fearing closing. It's almost a catch-22 of, well, money's already been pouring into these farms and yet they can't be profitable. And so what we try to do with the story is fine. Well, why can't that be the case? Even in really good years, farm income for the vast majority of farms is usually break even. It's usually they're not able to actually save money for whenever the economy goes into downturn. And most of a farm household's income comes from off-farm labor or, you know, other type of ways to use the land to make revenue, such as like energy projects or leasing out mineral rights. I mean, I think what we're seeing right now at this moment where so many of these really large commodity farms are being threatened with bankruptcy, it's pushing people to a brink where change has to happen of some kind. In the story, we have folks who are more reformists. They want to see Arkansas agriculture diversify in the Delta. They want to see different kinds of crops grown to where farmers are not so reliant upon global markets. Can we transition to more vegetables and fruits? Can we transition to more growing crops and selling those crops locally? There's a lot of crop challenges with that, of course, because the infrastructure in the Delta is built for, you know, shipping all of these crops down the Mississippi River, through the Gulf of Mexico and out to countries and refineries elsewhere, right? My main goal with the story is just to get people thinking, whether you're in farm country or not, about what should Arkansas agriculture look like? How can it serve farmers best? How can it serve consumers best? How can federal policy ensure that the system works best for everybody?
Even if there is some sort of emergency payment that comes from Congress that does keep Arkansas agriculture alive for at least another season, you know, what will these farmers do once they stop farming, and what will become of these communities if agriculture is no longer their primary industry?
There is a great deal of fear that if more people go out of business, they lose their land, they have to close up their farms, that there will be, you know, outside actors buying up the farmland in Arkansas increasingly. And that's not necessarily saying foreign adversaries like China, the Chinese government, or other countries. It's more like financial institutions, you know, private equity groups. Are they going to start buying up farmland, right? And then renting that farmland out to farmers or converting it to something else entirely? Retirement funds, are they going to start investing in the farmland to try to get returns for their, you know, investors? In the story, we write about how the Agricultural Council of Arkansas, the Farm Bureau, and many other industry advocacy groups have been in Washington, D.C. in the last several weeks, advocating to use some of the tariff revenue to backstop farms and with emergency payments, which is very similar to what happened during President Trump's first term in office. During the first trade war, is they used a lot of that tariff revenue to basically backstop a lot of the commodity farms that were hurting by trade being cut off with China. So that's what's happening again here. And so perhaps a deal can come through that can help farmers. What I also wanted to do with the story, and what I hope we did effectively, was kind of explore farm country's relationship with President Trump, because you hear a lot from coastal media, President Trump is, you know, screwing over his own voters, and how can these people vote for President Trump whenever he's doing tariffs that are negatively affecting their farms, right? You hear that a lot. And so we wanted to explore the nuance there, which is that, like, you know, a lot of farmers have been feeling for a long time that their economic model doesn't work, that they are exporting all these crops, they're farming better than they've ever had, and yet they still can't make any money. So going back to that point I made earlier. And so what they are hoping, why they believe in President Trump, is they really believe he can get them better trade deals. Like, the tariffs will bring about short-term pain, and then in the long term, hopefully they can get better trade deals and farm country can start thriving again. You know, China will agree to buy X amount of soybeans, which will give farmers a huge boon here in Arkansas. You know, that's kind of the hope. Now, it's not up to me to say whether that's naive or not as a hope, but that's genuinely, if you want to understand the relationship there, that's kind of why farm country does like Trump. And there's other reasons, of course, as well. There's more issues than just tariffs and, you know, exporting crops that could make someone support or not support a president. But we kind of get to that as well in the story. And I hope that gives people a really nuanced view of why so many in farm country, and not just in Arkansas, but elsewhere, really do still support the president and believe that, you know, these are good policy decisions that could, and hopefully at least, come benefit them some point in the future.
That was Philip Powell, reporter with the Arkansas Times. You can read his full story on the Arkansas agriculture crisis at arctimes.com. This weekend is the annual String Band Music and Arts Festival at the Ozark Folk Center State Park in Mountain View. KASU's Marty Scarborough spoke with Keith Szymanowicz, Promotions Director and Park Interpreter at the Ozark Folk Center, to learn more about the state's rich history of string band music.
A string band is what it sounds to be. You know, it's a string band is made up of acoustic stringed instruments. So string bands were all the rage back in the 1920s and 30s, very much a part of our American musical heritage. And, you know, the mission of the Folk Center fitting neatly into string band music, you know. So we can get into that. But, you know, string band music is sort of a forerunner of modern country music and bluegrass. And it existed, you know, a long time in this country, many years prior to that. So let's see, you know, during the 1800s, you know, musicians in the Ozarks played what we call now as old time music or old time string band music. It's a folk music that was really born in the Appalachian Mountains. Like I said, the original country music, you know, was heavily influenced by a melting pot of music and rhythm that were played by descendants of European and African American, you know, settlers, people that immigrated to this country or came as slaves, you know. They played string band instruments and played old time music, you know. It was formed in the mountains, just a uniquely American music. And over generations, traveled further and further west until it ended up here in the Ozarks.
Well, I'm glad you made the references to bluegrass and country music having come out of that string band tradition, because especially bluegrass shares a lot of the same instruments in playing this style of music. And a lot of the songs that were played by string bands in the 20s and 30s were later adapted and brought into the repertoire of bluegrass artists that emerged in the 40s and 50s. But is there a different way in playing some of those melodies that makes them uniquely string band, even though they may have later been adapted into bluegrass or country music?
Yeah, well, good question. So, no, I'll start by saying this and try to get back around to your question. But, you know, I would say 150 years ago or so, you would see, you know, instrumentation for a string band around this region of the Ozarks being primarily banjo, fiddle, and guitar, and maybe mandolin, the same sorts of instruments that you would see in Bill Monroe's Bluegrass Boys or you know, Flat Scruggs back in the 40s and 50s. So no drums, no piano, just acoustic stringed instruments. And, you know, you also might see somebody playing percussion too, making music with what they had, spoons or a pair of rhythm bones or washboard. But the fiddle was the primary driver of the string band. And of course, that's Arkansas's state instrument, so it's worthy of talking about a little bit. But the fiddle is really the heart of the string band. And it's what drove the local dances in our region and across the southern U.S. So on a Friday or Saturday night, you would see a fiddler or, you know, if you're lucky to have a couple or a few other instruments playing along. This brings to mind, you know, that some will say fiddle, some say violin. And you hear these kind of expressions like violins have strings, but the fiddle has strings, or you carry a violin in a case, but a fiddle in a tote sack. So there's kind of a cultural difference that those expressions are pointing to. But the primary difference, you know, is the style in which you play it. And I think this was kind of a style that carried on from old time music into bluegrass and into country. But, you know, especially in the olden days, there was a difference in style, but also a difference in the way people learn the instrument. You know, the classical violinist reads notes on the page, you know, and they play the music the way it's written on the page. But the fiddle player learns by ear. You know, this is how part of the folk music tradition, you know, the oral tradition of this music, it's passed down from generation by people simply hearing it. But the fiddle stylistically lends itself to improvisation, you know, for folks that are familiar with jazz music, you know. There's a sense of playing with feel and allowing for individuality of the player to come out. So, you know, rarely did people write down the notes for these songs, you know, but they varied based on who was playing them. And it was very common for a fiddler in the Arkansas Ozarks to play a tune very differently from somebody 50 miles north in southern Missouri. So, some common tunes that you'd hear in old time or even in bluegrass music, Ragtime Annie, Soldier's Joy, or Arkansas Traveler. And those are the kinds of songs that you still hear on our stage. But getting back around to your question, I think one of the primary differences in between an old-time string band, the way they would play a tune like Soldier's Joy versus a bluegrass band is the old-time band is all about playing the tune. It's less highlighting the fancy licks or solos of a musician versus playing the tune. And this really comes back to the point of what the purpose of the music was for. Of course, people enjoyed playing and gathering together, but dance was a huge part of old-time music. That was really the primary function was for dancing. So the band would be there to play for a square dance or people freestyle jig dancing. The dancing and the music really emerged together. And again, coming from this melting pot, evolving from European American dances and African American influences, but the music was very much the soundtrack for what you did with it as a community, as neighbors, in the community building or the local schoolhouse or in the yard of somebody's cabin, on a Friday or Saturday night, in the summertime you're out in the yard, and in the wintertime you pull out the furniture so you can dance inside. It was a way to meet folks for courtship, for finding a husband or a wife, and all of this tying into the music and the dance. The difference, I think, one of the big differences between what the old time string band was for, and later on how that music evolved into more of something that you sat and listened to, lots more notes, and maybe even driving and being played faster, as fast as you could play it, in some of this bluegrass band.
That was Keith Simanowitz, Promotions Director and Park Interpreter at the Ozark Folk Center State Park in Mountain View, talking about this weekend's String Band Music and Arts Festival. More information is online at arkansasstateparks.com. The 34th Annual Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival begins today. Ken Jacobson is the executive director of the festival. He spoke with KUAF's Sophia Narani to discuss this year's lineup of documentaries and other events taking place through next week.
So we kind of have something for everyone. It's an incredible variety this year. And I think, and I've been telling people this, that in my 3 years here, this is the strongest lineup that we've put together. We've got 46 feature-length documentaries from around the world. We have one documentary series. We have 48 shorts in 11 shorts programs. And we have some incredible, in-person events. Our three gala films. One is our opening night, which is always a special night, which is happening on October 10th at Oaklawn. And we're going to be showing the documentary Lost Wolves of Yellowstone by Tom Winston, a great film about a project 30 years ago. This is the 30th anniversary of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to bring wolves back into Yellowstone National Park. So, being here in a national park, we sort of have a kinship with Yellowstone being the first national park. So I think that's a really great way to kick things off. On Wednesday, the 15th, we are going to be showing the North American premiere of a new documentary called The Cowboy, directed by a German filmmaker named André Hormann. And this is an amazing story. It's kind of a longitudinal portrait of really starts out. He's a boy. He's 11 years old, living on a ranch with his family in Colorado. And his dream is very simple. He just wants to be a cowboy. And this filmmaker would shoot with him and follow his story every year for 10 years. So we see in the, when it's all put together in this film, we see this individual, his name's Crowley, grow up from age 11 to age 21. And it's just an amazing coming of age story and, all the ups and downs that come with pursuing a dream that's, as simple, but also as as hard to come by as being an American cowboy in this day and age. It's a beautifully made film, beautifully shot. The director will be here along with special guests. So that's going to be fun. And folks coming to that screening will be the first audience in North America that get to see that film. And then finally, closing night, we like occasionally, we did it last year, we're doing it again this year, to find a great music doc to show, because I think that really ends things on a high note and puts people in a great mood. So this year, we're featuring a wonderful documentary called Move Your Body, The Birth of House, which is directed by Elegance Bratton, and it's about the beginnings of house music, which I really, you know, didn't know the incredible story behind how this music was created, who the creators were, and just the whole culture that gave birth to, you know, this music, a really amazing, you know, account of these incredibly creative people who started this musical phenomenon. So we also really want to spotlight not only Southern stories and Southern filmmakers, but films by Arkansans. And so this year we're really honored to be able to show a new film from Craig Renault. Craig grew up in Little Rock, and he made films for quite a number of years with his brother Brent. And Brent tragically was killed covering the war in Ukraine. He was the first American journalist who was killed in the war. And 3 years later, Craig has made a really incredible film about his brother. It's, as you might expect, it's very personal, it's very intimate, but it also really highlights the dangers that filmmakers and journalists face when they go into conflict zones to cover wars. So Craig will be here. Juan Arredondo, who is also a filmmaker and journalist who was with Brent at the time he was killed, and Juan was also shot and injured. Juan will be here. And we know it's going to be a really, you know, powerful evening. And that's happening on Tuesday, October 14th at 5:45 at the Arlington. And I should mention our opening and closing nights this year, as they were last year, will be at Oaklawn at the Event Center there, which is a great place to show a movie and have a party. And then the middle 7 days will be at the Arlington. Two venues there. We build these out into real theaters. We have a professional team that comes in and does an amazing job with sound and picture quality. So we'll be showing movies morning, afternoon, and evening at the Arlington in the middle 7 days of the festival, from the 11th to the mid-afternoon on the 18th. And then that evening we go back to the Oaklawn for closing night. Folks can learn about that and everything about the festival at our website at hsdfi.org.
That was Ken Jacobson, Executive Director of the Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival, speaking with KUAF's Sophia Narani. The festival runs from October 10th through the 18th. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.